This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In an era when Christianity seems to straddle our politics like a colossus, attention is focused mostly on one leg, namely the one on the right. It's much easier to see with a clear outline and single purpose. But the left leg is also in motion, first on behalf of the abolitionist and suffrage movements, and ever after. To really understand, though, the considerable, if less visible, power of today's Christian left, Jack Jenkins, national reporter at Religion News Service, suggests we look back to the social gospel movement of a century ago. Jenkins, author of American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of Our Country, says the pastors behind the social gospel movement viewed the predation of the Industrial Revolution as a new kind of sin, not individual, but structural, corporate.
That there are these systems that are actually hurting and oppressing people. And around this same time, there was this critique of quote-unquote liberal Christianity coming from a group of Christians who would eventually call themselves the fundamentalists. And they saw the social gospel and other movements within liberal Christianity as incompatible with the gospel that they abided by. And so there was this major schism.
Then white Christian fundamentalists became an ascendant political force.
Yes, the religious right was a response to the success of liberal Christianity of the early 20th century. And the new religious left of today is in many ways a response to the success of the religious right in the 1990s and early 2000s. And it's worth noting that when these fundamentalists of the 1930s, who eventually rebranded themselves as evangelicals, when they kept losing in the public square, what they did is they kind of went back and formed their own counter-revolution in terms of their own media. So by the time you got to the ascendant religious right of the 1980s and 1990s, they had their own media apparatus ready to go to be able to help influence American politics.
But even though the religious left and the religious right counter each other, they're not mirror images. For one thing, the religious right is largely white and Christian, whereas, at least now, the religious left comprises multiple faiths.
Yes. And so to do things together often requires quite a bit of coalition building and community building and relationship building that you don't find on the religious right, because there's been this sort of contract established that they're going to work with a uniform message. One of the things that I've traced as a reporter is those moments in which the religious left is able to push in the same direction and make big change.
Show me where it was as powerful in pushing a policy as the Christian right has been.
The passage of the Affordable Care Act, one of the landmark pieces of liberal legislation of the past century. Barack Obama stood before a group of Catholics and said that the Affordable Care Act only got passed because of the influence of Catholic nuns and progressive religious people. The reason Barack Obama said that is that right around the very end of the Affordable Care Act fight, the head of the Catholic Health Association, Sister Carol Keehan, a Catholic nun, published in her own little magazine of the Catholic Health Association, which isn't widely read, this letter saying that she believed that it was time for a universal health care. And she had actually been deeply involved in the crafting of the bill and been in conversation with major liberal voices, such as John Podesta, for quite some time.
Yeah, but she didn't have a constituency of millions that the religious right can rely on.
Well, it actually depends on your interpretation of that. So what was interesting about her coming out and endorsing the bill when she did is that she was doing so in direct defiance of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who, you know, exhibited broad sway over American politics. But as it turns out, Catholic nuns have higher approval ratings with the American public than Catholic bishops do.
Oh.
And not only did she come out, but when this sort of tension emerged between her and the bishops, this whole slate of other Catholic nuns who lead other orders here in the United States also collectively came out and endorsed the Affordable Care Act to back her up. And then those nuns were then pushed by a group of progressive faith organizations that stood at the ready to really help push this bill across the finish line. And the end result was that the day that the bill was being passed in the House, Sister Carol Keehan, she was sitting in a hotel bar in Vatican City with John Podesta on her phone the entire time, calling Catholic members of Congress, pressuring them to vote for the bill. That is why when they ended up getting it passed, Barack Obama actually saved one of the pens that he signed the bill into law with for Sister Carol Keehan. The religious left can be very effective in precise moments. That's a moment of legislation, but they're also often very influential when it comes to broader protest movements.
Give me an example of that.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the bigger demonstrations of the last few years for liberals in general was the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina. That was led by Reverend William Barber.
He's a recurring figure in your book.
Yes. They were reacting to this Republican legislator that had swept into power in North Carolina. And this collective outcry over the course of years, I mean, there were hundreds of people arrested as part of these demonstrations that William Barber helped lead. You know, by the time you got to 2016 on election night, but one bright spot for Democrats was that the governor of North Carolina was unseated that night. And many political analysts actually cited the Moral Mondays movement led by William Barber as the chief reason. And since then, William Barber has proven to be not just one of the most influential figures in the religious left. William Barber has gone on to become one of the most influential activists in progressivism in general.
Cornel West, you said, described him as the closest person we have to Martin Luther King today. But what does his approach to organizing tell us about the religious left that supposedly has Jews and Hindus and Muslims as well as Christians in it? I'm sure I'm leaving some very important religions out.
Fusion politics, as he calls it, ultimately is his ability to get a diverse group of voices to show up and represent. And it's an interesting development within the religious left. They are one of the ones who can help get things started, but they don't pretend that they're the only voices in the room. In fact, they need all of those other religious voices who may not be like them and all those voices of people who definitely don't pray at all to show up to their initiatives as well.
I don't think anybody would argue that people of faith play a big role in the progressive movement, despite its depiction as completely atheistic. Where I remain unpersuaded by the argument is that the religious left is a block equal to white evangelicals in getting people elected.
It's a lot easier to point to white evangelicals in polling and say these folks voted, you know, X way. And it's harder to do that when you have this menagerie of different faith voices and having to poll extensively on their affiliations and, you know, seeing how they voted on election day. Although there have been moments in which they have made a profound impact. I mean, for instance, you know, Black Protestants are one of the most important constituencies within the Democratic Party. One big moment in the last few years was the election of Doug Jones as the Democratic senator from Alabama. You know, he was up against Roy Moore, who was a uniquely flawed candidate. But it's important that one of the key reasons he was able to become one of the first Democratic senators from the state of Alabama in some time was that Black Protestants showed up in a huge way. And in fact, Joe Biden can probably attribute his success primarily to that community.
I totally get that. I see that as the most identifiable, the most politically hefty subset of the religious left.
One big frustration for religion journalists for several years now has been that there is just wildly uneven polling regarding any group other than white evangelical Protestants and Catholics. So it requires a lot of reporting about what we see on the ground without being able to verify it necessarily with data.
So why is it harder for journalists to cover the religious left?
they're covering the religious right because the religious right has proven to be very powerful. But I think another big part of this is that the religious right cast the left as something that is inadequately religious. And it is true that one of the largest groups within the Democratic Party are the quote-unquote religiously unaffiliated. And religiously unaffiliated are not necessarily atheists and agnostics, although they are also within that group. You know, the religious right can point to that statistic and say, oh, you know, this is a godless party. That narrative has influenced the way a lot of political journalists have covered religion and politics. And I do think covering the religious left is really hard. I mean, you're having to cover a wide variety of faith groups that often have different theological structures or have various different forms of infighting within them. I mean, Native American spirituality is not the same thing as covering an Episcopal priest, which is not the same thing as covering a Muslim community. And like that sort of stuff can be really intimidating to the average political journalist who just wants to see who's going to win on election day.
Does it matter? Does it matter how the religious left is covered?
It always matters to not be misled by, you know, simplistic narratives. It always behooves us to, you know, get at what's truly going on. If the religious right won the argument to say that they are, you know, this authentic form of faith, that can have repercussions for smaller religious communities that might get left out. Their religious liberty won't necessarily be protected if a Muslim American's faith isn't deemed to be as credible as a white evangelical's, if a Native American's faith isn't deemed as credible as a white Catholic's. That can have dire repercussions in the courts, at the ballot box, and just in society. You know, one of the reasons that I became fascinated with this topic is because I do think that it's an important thing to cover. And that if we don't, we miss these important moments of influence. If the exact same things were happening on the right, you would see any number of think pieces. But we don't talk about it on the left, and I think that's just missing a really interesting story.
Jack, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jack Jenkins is a national reporter at Religion News Service and author of American Prophets: The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country.
Coming up, America's unique, ubiquitous image of Jesus. You know it, blonde, blue-eyed, a certain resemblance to Errol Flynn. Soon you'll know why.
This is On the Media.